At the same time, the other major wave of UFO activity was in a place about as opposite as Hest Island as you can imagine, just north of New York City, what is known as the Hudson Valley. In the case of Hest Island, you have a couple of sparse witnesses trying to record this. In the case of the Hudson Valley, you have thousands of people driving along, say, the Taconic Parkway at night, and they would see something that looks like this, hovering over them, stopping, shining an intense beam of light onto the ground, like out of a movie. Except this wasn't a movie. You'd get out of your car, you would see this thing. People in the back seat of your car would be screaming. This happened many times. There was a lot of mental communication with these objects, at least alleged mental communication. People would say, one woman said, come here, I want to look at you more closely, and the object came to her. She got scared. She said, please get back, and the object moved away. You get this many times with the Hudson Valley. Now pretend that you are the representative of the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, and the media starts to come to you and to ask for you to explain what exactly was going on. Well, what would you tell the public? You might be in a bit of a problem, wouldn't you? I don't think you would say, well, there appear to be these football field-sized boomerangs hovering over the highway, but don't worry, I don't think they're here to eat us. There's really not a good way to get into this topic. So what do? Well, they blame it on private pilots of these so-called microlights or ultralight aircraft flying in formation illegally at night, presumably carrying intensely heavy spotlights with them, not crashing into each other, not getting caught. You know, I mean, think about how stupid that is. And yet, if you didn't see it yourself, well, then you might think, okay. The problem was that every single eyewitness said, that's ridiculous. That's absurd. But it worked. It worked enough, even to this day. Not among UFO researchers, but if you go to the mainstream and try to get an explanation for this, that's what you're going to read. That's the first thing that you're going to read. It's believed to be private pilots playing pranks. It's absurd. This image here on the top is a video frame taken from July 24th. You know, this frame was taken to the Jet Propulsion Lab, this video, rather, in Pasadena. And the only thing that we can say about it is that they analyzed it and said it's something, but it's not an aircraft of any that we could identify. It's something unconventional. It was taken the same day that there was a sighting over the Indian Point nuclear facility in the Hudson Valley of an absolutely enormous three football field long object, triangle, that came over the plant, hovered over the only operating reactor, and just stayed there for a while. The plant manager had his guards aim their shotguns at this object, if you can imagine. And I don't know what he was expecting them to do about this thing. Was about to call the National Guard to send a helicopter over to try to shoot this thing down or do something with it. And then it just moved off. We know about this because Phil Imbrogno, the primary researcher of this, was allowed, incredibly, to get an interview, a one-time interview with the guards of this plant. And that's the drawing that they gave him. This is another photograph from the Hudson Valley. They weren't all triangles. They weren't all boomerangs. This is from 1987, Dansville, Connecticut. I believe this was taken by a police officer, Dansville, Connecticut. Interesting leaks, yes, versus conservative ufology. Basically, what you have in the mid-80s is all this stuff is breaking out. And you get the old guard. And I don't mean to demean these individuals. This is from a MUFON convention of the early 80s. Some of these people are easily identifiable. Many of them excellent researchers. But it's an old boys club, if you really notice. It's all a bunch of guys standing around. And there was a great deal of resistance throughout, not just in the mainstream media, but among UFO researchers, to the Hudson Valley cases. Researchers didn't all just latch on to that. Oh, my God, there's these triangles. A lot of them actually, believe it or not, did argue initially that these were probably the FAA's telling the truth. A lot of researchers were very much disinclined to look into abductions. A lot of researchers absolutely would not look at cattle mutilations. They said that's totally different from UFOs. And then crop circles, which I'll discuss a little bit down the road, also were often dismissed by ufologists throughout the 1980s. It took a long time. Another interesting thing of the mid-80s is this topic. That's a photograph of Ben Rich, the then head of Lockheed Skunk Works Division. All of you know is probably the coolest aviation division that we know of. Designed the U-2 aircraft and the stealth fighter and so on. Ben Rich, like a lot of aviation executives, what you find when you scratch the surface is they're all into UFOs, just about every single one of them. I don't think there's an exception. Ben Rich was into UFOs. Sure he was. John Andrews, a colleague of his, with his own very excellent credentials in the field, wrote to Ben Rich in 1986 and said, "Ben, I just want to know what you think about this topic. Are these ours or are these extraterrestrial? Who's making the UFOs?" An interesting thing about this letter, by the way, from John Andrews is that he references a very interesting event in UFO research that was not well known, that shows that these aviation guys were interested in UFO research. And what he referenced is a letter by a Dr. Sarbacher. You can see it down there. It's not as clear as you'd want, but down, no, I can't really reach it from there. What that letter said, Robert Sarbacher was a defense scientist in the 1950s. And it turned out, it was discovered by Canadian researcher Arthur Bray, who found some documents in the papers of a deceased researcher named Wilbert Smith. One thing leads to another, and we find out that Robert Sarbacher was a defense scientist in the 1950s who talked about alien bodies to this other researcher who was then dead. I just lost my screen. Can somebody help me here? My computer just went black. It just went black. I don't know what to do there. So what happened was Sarbacher was still alive in 1983. And so some researchers found him, Stanton Friedman and William Steinman primarily. And are we dead there? We have a situation. It's okay. So William Steinman wrote to Sarbacher and said, "Is this true? Did you talk about this topic to this other researcher?" And Sarbacher said, "Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I did. As a matter of fact, I attended meetings in which we discussed the retrieval of alien wreckage." He said, "I did not personally participate in such retrievals, but I was at meetings, I was at least one meeting at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base where we discussed this." And he said, in fact, the discussion was that these creatures were insect-like, basically unlike anything that we have on Earth here. So, okay. Well, you know what? We're just working the bugs out the first time. So once this is done, we'll be all set. So the point is that John Andrews, who wrote this letter to Ben Rich, was very much aware of the Sarbacher letter, which was not something that was getting any kind of wide media circulation, but the aviation community was involved. And the answer that Ben Rich gave to John Andrews was simply, "Yes, I'm a believer in both categories." He says, "I believe that there are extraterrestrial and I believe that there are man-made UFOs." Now, the key about that is Ben Rich is saying, "I believe." So you might argue, well, he doesn't know. This is he's offering his belief. But you have to realize Ben Rich was a CEO of a major operation. You have to realize how these people talk. He's not just going to say, "Oh, yes, of course, it's all true." You have to cover your backside at all times. And I am sure that is what Ben Rich did. In particular, when you consider... How are we doing there? All right. In 1993, not long before Ben Rich died, he gave a talk at the UCLA School of Engineering for an alumni thing there. One attendee of this was a MUFON member and a corporate executive named Jan Harzin. Ben Rich ended that presentation with a discussion of the F-117, and then said after that, "We now have the technology to take E.T. home." And then ended the meeting on that note. Well, you know, people are all different. So some people have absolutely no curiosity in any bone of their body. So 3/4 of the group just filed out with that statement. Like, okay, fine, whatever. But a few people stayed behind, and they surrounded Rich, and they said, "What do you mean by that statement?" And so there was a discussion for a while, and what Ben Rich said to them was, "We now have the technology to take E.T. home. There was an error in our equations, and we figured it out. We can now take E.T., we can now fly to the stars, and it won't take a lifetime to do it." And then he said, the secret is so black, it is so deep, that it would take an act of God to release it. He said, the secret should come out, but there is too much behind the secrecy to enable this easily to be done. Those are Ben Rich's statements, and you've got to take these seriously. He's not just some guy off the street. This is Ben Rich who ran Skunk Works. Ben Rich knew everyone that he ever wanted to know, I'm sure. And that was what he said. How are we doing here? All right, we're close. I forgot to bring my harmonica. I feel kind of bad about that now. Do a little tap dance. Ben Rich's statement, the second one that I referred to, was in 1993. I have the date. I'm not recalling the date offhand. It's in the book. Great. That's this one, 2009, right there. Double click that. I'll scroll through. I'm going to get it. All right. Sorry about this, guys. All right, great. I'm going to scroll through here, and this is an odd kind of mouse. You know those little the mouse with the dot in the middle of the keyboard? What's up with that? Okay. Here we go. This is there. We okay? Good. Okay, and now we're going to. Awesome. Okay, let me just go back here. Okay, I'm on the correct slide here. Let's just move ahead.
There you go.
Well, we're getting through. We're all big people here. Okay, great. That's fine. I don't think I need it. Okay, are we on there? So once you get to the screen, here we go. There were some really great sightings of 1986 in particular. We have Dalnogorsk in Soviet Union, Brazil, and Alaska. All of them just dramatic cases. And again, my goal in this book is simply to provide as accurate, as clear a description of them as I can. Those are some images here of the Japanese encounter, not Japanese, the Alaskan encounter. This is a Japanese-American pilot who saw this object that dwarfed his own aircraft. It's a great, great case. The one in Brazil is also another great case. You've got the Brazilian Air Force in large numbers chasing these object that was seen going through a large part of that country. Very well documented. That's part of a U.S. Defense memo that describes what was going on at the time. And the Dalnogorsk case could very well be an instance of a downed UFO. It's not really clear what that thing was. But it's interesting. One of the things that breaks the world open in the 1986 is the baby internet. What a lot of people may not realize is that UFO research was one of the key drivers of the early internet. It really was. The earliest form of the internet wasn't the web, of course. It was bulletin boards. And the earliest bulletin boards were all for computer geeks and programmers and stuff like that. The first non-bulletin board ever that was significant was called Paranet. It was a UFO-related bulletin board. Think about how significant that is. So in 1986, UFOs really helped to open up the internet significantly. And what that meant was, see, up until that time, if you were a researcher and you wanted to get your word out, well, really, you had limited options. You'd write an article, you'd send it to the MUFON Journal or the IUR or the APRO Bulletin, if that were still around. And they had editorial policies and limited space and so on. Suddenly, all you needed now was a computer with a modem, and you can write whatever you wanted, and boom, it's out there. And not only that, but you get more readers than the old journals had. So it instantly transformed not just the world, but it transformed ufology as well. And what happened was you get this kind of rift between the old school and the new school. No surprise. All these outsiders start coming into our field. Who are you? What are your credentials? Well, guess what? They didn't really need them, did they, to say their piece and to get their word out. And so what ended up happening is that it caused a veritable explosion within the field of UFO research. And within a few short years after that, all these outsiders started talking about a lot of, you know, taking the ball from, like, all the crash retrieval information, all this subterranean stuff going on, and just running with it. And hence the chapter Ufology Explodes, 1987 to 88. Here's some of the interesting things going on here. Gulf Breeze is a big, big part of this. The entrance of Bill Cooper and John Lear into the UFO field. The release of the MJ-12 documents. Again, the ramping up of the abduction debate. Whitley Strieber has a bestseller dealing with abductions. Bud Hopkins wrote Intruders, following up from his first book. Both of these were major, major influences on UFOs and once again brought the abduction phenomenon to the forefront of UFO research. The breakout of MJ-12. God, this is another of these minefields, and you can't avoid it. What does one think about MJ-12? These documents that come out allegedly, they look like they're real. They look genuine. Are they genuine? Here's my take on MJ-12. There's a debate going on right now, for those of you following this on the message boards, been argued that they're a hoax. I would not ever argue that these documents are a simple hoax or a hoax at all. Are they part of a disinformation program? I would say that's probably so. That doesn't mean that they're fake. It's a big difference. 20 months before the MJ-12 documents were released at the end of 1984, Linda Moulton Howe had her own encounter with Richard Doty at Air Force Intelligence at Kirtland Air Force Base. Many of you know of this. What happened there? Doty showed Linda Moulton Howe a variety of documents, presidential briefing papers, dealing with all the stuff that you get in the MJ-12 documents a year and a half later, with a few differences. Linda Howe was shown information about a crash in Aztec, New Mexico. Well, that didn't happen in the MJ-12 documents. Linda Howe was told information about living aliens that were brought, that were captured, whereas in the MJ-12 documents a year and a half later, they were all dead. There are key differences. And the thing about what Linda Howe went through, she wasn't allowed to write anything down, but she did go immediately to her hotel after her meeting with Doty and wrote everything down. And she's got a near photographic memory, and she remembers it. And I think most reasonable people would believe that she's giving an accurate portrayal of what she saw. So the question is, what do you do about this? Well, my impression of MJ-12 is that it's part of an ongoing effort to throw dirt, throw mud over this research. So again, we need to understand what true disinformation is. It's not lies. You take something that's true and you alter it. You alter the document. You put things in there that make it untenable. Or you package it in such a way. You give different versions of something. You put those versions out so that people argue forever and ever about it. And you can't agree. And this way, if it's true information then, that information has been effectively disabled forever. And I think that's what happened. And I think that there were some researchers who were just played by the intelligence community in this affair. And how deep their involvement goes in intelligence, we may never truly know. One interesting thing about MJ-12, I think a very strong support is this man, Dr. Eric Walker. Another of these inside leaks, like Robert Starbucker and like Ben Rich, people who talk about this. Eric Walker was a one-time president of Penn State University, another defense scientist in the 50s and so on. And just so happened, he let his guard down for a long enough period of time with a couple of researchers and talked at length about MJ-12. There's a lot about that in my book. The John Lear statement, end of 1987, John Lear, son of William Lear, who invented the Lear jet, and John Lear, very highly, possibly the highest rated pilot at the time, makes a statement about a human-alien deal. The aliens abduct people. In return, we get some of their technology. And he says, you're being sold out, people. Another minefield. All I can do at certain times, I can't conclude. It's hard. I can't be the judge with the gavel on every single case. The best that I can do sometimes is just clearly explain, show every side that I can, and move on. The thing, though, is that John Lear made his statement on Paranet, and again, it's just another example of how the internet essentially blew up UFO research. U.S. Coast Guard had an amazing encounter in 1988 with a UFO. That's a photograph. I got that from Bruce Maccabee. If you can show it, it looks like a triangle. What you find is that the photograph itself, you see that white strip, this is the edge of the negative. The way this particular camera was designed, the photograph went inside that strip. That's legitimate, according to Bruce. You can see it there. What happened was a bunch of people were driving along Lake Erie at, around dusk, and they see this intense light display over the frozen lake. They pull over, they watch it, it releases other objects, they fly around the lake, they get scared. These people go to their house, they call the Coast Guard. Coast Guard comes over, watches this incredible display. A lot of people in the area watched the display. Another person took that photograph. And the Coast Guard wrote up a long, detailed report of the event. Then wrote another report the following day in which they dismissed the whole thing. They said, it was nothing. Gulf Breeze. You want to know what I think of Gulf Breeze? It was real, and Ed Walters was real. That is my opinion. You want to disagree with me? Be my guest. I spent a lot of time on this one trying to decide what I think, and that's what I think. These photographs also courtesy of Bruce Maccabee. Let me use them. This first photograph, this is the very first one Ed Walters took. The objects behind that tree, it's a pretty good fake with a Polaroid. I don't think he faked it. And I do believe, and this is another one, and then there's the famous, infamous, whatever, road shot. There was a model that turned up. A lot of you know about this. A model of the Gulf Breeze object that was found in the former attic where Ed Walters had owned this house. And it was said, well, he made this model, and that proves he was faking these things. And no, actually what it proves is that there was a dirty tricks operation to set up Ed Walters. That model was made. It was proven to be made long after he vacated that house. Someone went into the attic, planted this thing, and it was found. And the nature in which it was found, I really went into this. I tried to figure this all out. Someone was trying to set up Ed Walters. That, again, I'm just giving you my opinion. Gulf Breeze represented something real. William Cooper. You know, I think William Cooper was a man who had legitimate experiences. And in particular, in the beginning, he seemed to be somewhat more level-headed than what he became later. But I do believe that what happened with Bill Cooper is that he was not a stable man. The stories that he claimed for himself can be proven, were given to him by John Lear. And I think Cooper was just someone who glommed on to certain things in this field and left a trail of destruction behind him forever and ever, trashing the reputation of ufology. It's a spectacular show that this man left behind him. And so I think his appearance in ufology was very, very unfortunate. One thing I'll say about Cooper, though, this is a guy who, long before anyone was doing this, was talking about things like the Jason Society and the Bilderberger Group. Nobody did this in ufology in 1989, 1990, except Cooper. And you know what? I think that there's a lot to that. Nothing is ever simple in this world. There's no black and white. There's a lot of nuance. There's a lot of gray area. The alien reproduction vehicle. I don't know if John Alexander's in the audience, but he wrote an article not long ago on why the ARV could not have happened. That's the ARV. I believe the ARV absolutely existed. I've interviewed my own number of people on this. I am satisfied this is a true story. The story is that in 1988, in November of 88, a couple of gentlemen, one in particular was at an air show. They went to a secret air show in a big, big hangar and saw three flying saucer-like vehicles hovering off the ground. There was a display, video display of some of them, of one of them. There was a general at a podium speaking about this, talking at length about it, a four-star general, I was told, and calling it an alien reproduction vehicle. In other words, what came through very clear during this encounter was that their stuff somehow got into our possession, and we reproduced it, and guess what? We built it, and we succeeded, and according to that lecture that the general gave, we're going off-world. That's in 1988. There's a lot of reasons to support this. All right, you have the journalistic efforts of James Goodall. James Goodall was an aerospace journalist, knew a lot of people at Groom Lake, knew a lot of aviation insiders who said the exact same things to him. Mid-1980s, we have stuff that would make George Lucas envious. We're better literally than Star Wars or Star Trek or anything you can imagine by the mid-1980s. This is a drawing, incidentally, of the ARV by Mark McCandlish, an aviation illustrator, which Mark allowed me to use for the next book. So we're almost toward the end here. I got to keep it moving here, going a little slow. I'm blaming all of it on the technical difficulties. That's what I'm going to tell Steve. So let's move on. Growing schism in UFO research. I'm going to skip past some of this. I mean, the Bob Lazar story. Oy, landmine number, 138 of the book. We could just read what I would say about Lazar. I'm going to skip. I think that there's a lot of legitimacy to what Lazar said, too. People are going to look at this and they say, my God, he believes every single thing. It's not true. Not true at all. But there's something to the Lazar story. I am convinced. I do not and will not believe that this is all fiction. There's something going on there. Bob Lazar is the guy, of course, who made Area 51 common knowledge. He kind of got the phrase out there. Turns out, gosh, there is this place, Area 51. Is it possible that Bob Lazar was worked on in terms of mind control in some way? I think the answer is probably yeah. He himself would acknowledge that possibility. Does he remember everything exactly right? Probably not. Are his physics good or bad? Well, probably not all that good, but that itself is secondary. Because there's really, he was in no position really to grasp the physics in only a few times that he said he was at this place anyway. So, yes, I think that there's a lot of legit. And the other thing about Lazar, incidentally, is that when you listen to George Knapp talk about Bob Lazar, George Knapp is a journalist who broke the Lazar story. George has said publicly that he has about 20 people he's interviewed who were insiders at Groom Lake who fundamentally corroborated what Bob Lazar said. Various parts here and there. George has said this publicly. He said it in public in front of a bunch of Lazar debunkers and still defended Lazar. I got to George privately and I said, well, what do you really think about Lazar? I said, well, basically, I think he's fundamentally truthful. Not everything. A lot of things I wouldn't take to the bank. But he said, yes, basically, I think that his story is fundamentally true. Mid-1989, Bill Moore confesses to the MUFON convention. This is one convention I really wish I could have been at. Confessed that he had done disinformation for Air Force intelligence, and people start throwing rotten tomatoes at him and whatever. And he runs off the stage, and that's the end of Bill Moore's career in ufology. I think that there is even more going on than that. And I can't prove it, but I think that there was a deeper intelligence connection going on with all of that, and some of that I try to bring out in this book. Soviet Union, here's an interesting thing about the Soviet Union. As it was in the process of splitting apart into 100 little pieces, Okay, remember Mikhail Gorbachev, glasnost, perestroika, openness, restructuring. Well, it's relevant for our own situation. You want to open the books on UFOs? Well, in Gorbachev's case, he opened the books on the Soviet Union, and in 6 years, there was no Soviet Union. Food for thought. One of the things that happened is that UFO reports started coming out in this new spirit of openness. An enormous number of UFO reports started coming out. Some very strange ones, some very kind of solidly reported ones. The Belgian Triangles. One of the Soviet cases took place in March 1990 near Moscow. It was an extraordinary case. Around the same time that you get these Belgian Triangles in late 1989, early 1990. There's, of course, the famous image of the Belgian Triangle. This thing outperformed F-16 interceptors. If not this, then something that looked exactly like it. It was able to drop altitude of almost 4,000 feet in 1 second, according to Belgian Air Force radar. That's almost a mile in 1 second. It could go very, very slow. It could go very, very fast. F-16s had no chance with this. Is that something that's flown by the black world? Well, maybe. If it is, does that mean it's U.S. Air Force? Doubt it. Are there agencies that are totally off the grid right now? Probably. Yes, probably. The people who argue that, you know, well, there's no government conspiracy. I've looked into the government agencies and there's nothing there. Well, in a sense, that's probably true. But, of course, the other side of it is that are we to pretend that there's no such thing as a black executive branch of government? The National Security Agency existed for almost 15 years and nobody knew. No one in Congress knew. The NRO, 30 years. All right, do you really think that there's no, that part of our history is gone, that there are no secret agencies anymore? We've got missing trillions of dollars of money, and that is something else that I discuss in this book. There's a lot of money that's gone missing. A lot. By the early 1990s, 1994, there was a law passed requiring the federal government to account for itself in a business-like manner, at least for a little while there. And during that period of time, for the next 7 years or 8 years, you would have these periodic reports. We're missing $1 trillion. We're missing $2 trillion. Rumsfeld famously said this in 2001, right, not long before 9/11. 2.6 amended to $2.3 trillion. How do you lose $2.3 trillion when your budget in the Pentagon is 1/7 or 1/8 that amount? I don't know. There's a lot of missing money. We know that. So when you have basically an infinite amount of money to play with and total secrecy, well, you can do a lot of things. Could you come up with breakthroughs? Could you create what I now am calling a breakaway civilization? Yeah, I think so. Antelope Valley in Area 51, this is where a lot of this stuff was being tested, I believe. I think many of us believe. These are some photographs from that area. Let's move on. Crop circles make their... Crop circles, of course, you know, you can argue, go back long, long time, long way, but they really evolve in the 1980s. They kind of take off. And the problem from a UFO research point, this is Alton Barnes, 1990. It's an extraordinary, absolutely, you know, one of the key early major crop circles. They appear overnight. These things are immense. Hoaxers have not been caught unless they wanted to be caught. But these things come up overnight. They're precise. They're mathematical in all kinds of intricate, sophisticated ways. There have been studies done on the stalks that appear to show very bizarre peculiarities about them, being subjected to very intense microwave-like heat at a very, very specific part of the stalk. What does that? That's not done by a plank of wood. Is there some satellite up there doing a little scroll? I mean, really, I wonder, you know, do they have the ability? Is this an intelligence operation by you put the right program in and you scroll out your design and is that what's happening? Or is there someone else doing this? Well, I think it's a legitimate part of the UFO phenomenon. Last chapter I call False Dawn. Why? Well, you know, the Cold War was supposed to be over. Dawn is arriving, the end of the Cold War, the peace dividend. Didn't happen, did it? It was a false dawn. These are the subsections of that chapter. And let me just talk a little bit about them. It gets more and more interesting as we move into the future. Aviation Weekly, aerospace publication, nearly spilled the beans. What do I mean? Well, in October of 1990, one of the issues describes the unconventional aircraft that were being seen in places like Antelope Valley and over the Ellis Range in Nevada. Triangles. Triangular shaped aircraft. What are these? Well, we don't, you know, it's almost 20 years later and we still don't officially have triangles. But we do have triangles. Someone got their wrists slapped, presumably at Aviation Weekly. This, by the way, is where Philip Klass worked. I would love to have been behind the scenes at one of the editorial meetings after that issue came out. There's some information on some of the key groups at Antelope Valley, at the Lockheed Martin facility, Northrop Grumman, McDonnell Douglas. A lot of the U.S. black budget aircraft projects were done there. Lots of strange sightings of aircraft and UFOs in that area. They were building something. They still do. I talk a little bit about the Gulf War and control of the media in this book. Not a lot, but a little bit. I think it's significant. It's not UFO related per se, but in a sense it is. I mean, look, Gulf War, one of the defining turning points of our era. One of the things that's interesting, one of the many things interesting about the Gulf War is how the media had total control, how the military had total control over the media. There was a document known as Annex Foxtrot. It needs to be better understood than it is today. Requiring journalists, if you were a journalist in the Gulf War and you wanted to interview a soldier, you had to get approval. You couldn't just go do it. You had to get approval from the military to interview a soldier or visit the front line. And then, when you did that, you had to be accompanied by an officer. And then, after you wrote the article, that had to be subject to military censorship. Military's argument was, well, we don't want information going to the enemy. Well, when you think about how lopsided that war was, is that really the fear? Or is it rather simply, we want control of public opinion? I think that's the answer. There is no photographic record of combat in the Gulf War made by journalists. Peter Arnett stayed behind in Baghdad against the wishes of the Bush at White House and was vilified as this horrible person. How dare you stay behind in Baghdad and filming the destruction of that city by American bombs? He was accused of unpatriotic journalism. Of course, the man was Australian. Pulitzer Prize winner. Here's something that I discuss in this book, a possible abortive UFO disclosure of 1991. It's controversial, I admit. This was discussed in Robert Collins' book, Exempt from Disclosure. So was it true? Well, the story is that in the summer of 91, there was an attempt to bring the issue of UFOs to the president at the time, President Bush, an issue that was going to be raised at his retreat in Kennebunkport, Maine. I think that this happened. I have an independent verification of this from a very high-level individual who wasn't part of that group, but did tell me. This is someone very high up with CIA, who said, yes, I was certainly aware of these attempts at that time, for what it's worth. The story, incidentally, is that Dick Cheney, Secretary of Defense, said absolutely no way, no how. It's not going to happen. Not that it would have anyway. It seemed to be a kind of minority position within the highest power structure of the Bush White House. I have another source who said to me that this issue comes up every 5 years or so. In other words, the idea of raising this disclosure issue. It's a problem. When you have a secret that's this big for so many years, you've created an entire infrastructure around a pack of lies. Not everyone has the same opinion. Right? Back in ancient Rome, Caesar and Cicero didn't have the same opinion. And guess what? Today, at the top of our power structure, people don't have the same opinions either. There are those who say there's no way we're giving up the secret. And there are others who say, wait a minute, we have to find a way to let this out. We're creating an untenable situation. And so the issue does percolate. It comes up. It doesn't die. Not just at the citizen level, but also at the insider highest levels. It hasn't happened yet, but that doesn't mean it won't. When it happens, we all know it's going to be a big firestorm, won't it? It's not going to be easy. UFOs in space. Let me talk a little bit about UFOs in space. Soviet cases. See, this is one of the reasons why disclosure is going to be so difficult, is because there's a lot of space activity. This photograph is from the Soviet Phobos 2 failure in 1989. It's a photograph taken by their satellite. They're on a mission to Mars. Now, Mars has two moonlets, not really moons. One of them is called Phobos. And it so happened that the Soviet mission was called Phobos 2, so not to get confused there. That's a photograph of the moonlet Phobos. It's the last image taken by this satellite. And this little vertical line below it is an unknown object. And this object is estimated to be maybe 15, 20 kilometers long. It was the lasting photograph before the satellite went out. What was that? Well, we don't know. But there was a lot of strangeness about that mission. Soviets had a lot of other UFO sightings that are interesting and sufficiently documented that I think we can say confidently they happened. You have a lot of U.S. cases. One other thing from my good friend Ron Regeer that he was able to help me out with this book is a database known as the Individual Target Event Database, nicknamed the Itty Bitty. And Ron Regeer worked at a company called Aerojet, a defense contractor, where they helped to make what were called the DSP satellites, the Defense Support Program satellites. These, you can argue, are ideal for UFO hunting. There's a lot of them out there, and they're very good at identifying certain anomalous signals in Earth's atmosphere. Ron gave me his, he was able legally, accidentally but legally, to get a database of hundreds of DSP satellites tracking what were called fast walkers, that is, UFOs in space. And in the period that I cover in this book, 1973 to 1991, the DSP satellites tracked 283 space-based UFOs, about one per month, more than one per month, including, in fact, they tracked the Iranian case in September 1976, that famous incident that I referred to earlier in this lecture. The DSP satellites tracked the UFO right over Tehran at that time. Interesting. So in other words, what I'm saying is that our satellites are tracking these things all the time. Then there are other interesting events that I think have to be taken into consideration. I was in communication with a former Air Force telecom specialist named Simone Mendez. I have her military records that she allowed me to study. During the early 80s, she worked at Nellis Air Force Base with a top secret clearance. And in October 1981, a friend gave her a top secret message. She wasn't supposed to get this. The message said that NORAD had detected deep space objects entering Earth's atmosphere. She got into a lot of trouble over this. And it really caused a lot of problems in her life subsequently. The Strategic Defense Initiative, known as Star Wars, I believe and I argue that there was probably an ET component to this program. Can't prove it, but I think there's good reasons to argue that there was. Here's one reason to argue that there was probably a Star Wars component, an ET component to Star Wars, the famous STS video from 1991. And you've all seen this. I'm not going to play the video here, but you know there's an object that comes in from space toward Earth orbit. You see it. There's a flash in the bottom left portion of the screen, and an object comes from that on an intercept of the first object, which then turns around and takes off. Been studied and argued at great length. James Oberg, the NASA skeptic spokesperson, said, no, that's ridiculous. That's an ice crystal, and the flash was a rocket boosting. Although, as Jack Kasher argued, well, there's absolutely no movement in anything when that flash occurs. It doesn't look like there's any movement at all. How can you say that's a rocket? Anyway, one person argues with the next, and who knows? I think Kasher's argument's excellent. Military abductions. Here's another hot button issue. I could have waited to volume 3 to get into this, but I felt I really couldn't. Had to deal with it. It's important. This is Carla Turner. She's not with us any longer, unfortunately. I think Carla Turner was a very courageous individual. What was her story? Well, she, we're almost done here, by the way, started remembering abduction experiences with her husband in the late 80s, early 90s, went through regression, remembered things that happened to her, started interviewing other people, other abductees. Long story short, many of those individuals they recalled, some of them very consciously, without regression, they just remembered, that they were taken not simply by aliens, but by military-type people. Some of them seemed to be working with aliens or non-humans. It's not all very clear. They discussed things like cloning rooms and virtual reality scenarios and telepathic communication and human-alien collaboration, human souls being put in containers, for goodness sake, human military personnel in underground bases, cloning rooms, grays, insectoids, reptoids, humanoids, blue humanoids, dwarves, and so on and so on. What Carla Turner argued, I think this is exactly right, is that a revolution has taken place. A hidden power of structure has, quote, appropriated the UFO phenomenon. And, and ordinary politics are irrelevant. Who's in charge? Well, another thing I try to deal with. If you've gone to any of the Rex conference lectures I've given, this is usually the main thing I've talked about. The structure of secrecy. How does it all work out? Who's in charge? Well, it's hard to know exactly, but we can have some ideas. A, we know that there's ongoing military encounters with UFOs, and we have official silence. Military agencies often seem to be in the dark on this. We have a black budget with an enormous amount of missing money. We have a black infrastructure certainly developed that grew up to deal with this problem. They're outside of congressional control. They're outside of media influence or investigation. Who's in charge? Well, very probably international private entities. You don't need to look at UFOs to understand this. It's not hard to see that private entities dominate U.S. government policy on almost anything you can imagine. Not just the U.S. government, but all governments. They use special access programs, that is primordial, the black budget programs, as their tool, their primary tool to get money to do what they want to do and in total secrecy and total security. It's one of the key things, I think. Within black budget system, you have an enormous amount of security over what you do. You can build your own infrastructure. What happened? You know, think about during science during the Cold War. Western scientists and Soviet scientists. They didn't always communicate with each other, did they? Now, there was a common scientific language. They kind of sort of knew what the other guys were doing, but not totally. To some extent, you had a different infrastructure. Okay? Well, what if you have all this money and all this secrecy and security, and let's say, pretend, that with your acquired piece of alien hardware, you make a breakthrough. You discover something really important. Would you necessarily share that with the outside world? Well, you might not. And if you didn't, would that breakthrough lead to another breakthrough, which would give you a kind of runaway effect? It's certainly possible. We have to concede it's possible. And if it happened, what if those breakaways became so substantial that that infrastructure becomes essentially off the grid and doesn't, in a sense, need the rest of us? They can go off-world. They can play with space and time. They've got their advanced artificial intelligence. And they can do what they want, and they don't really need to have reference to us. I think that's entirely possible, and we have to consider this. I call it a breakaway civilization. Do they interact with alien species? If I were to guess, I would say, sure they do. That's just about the end. I'm nearly done here. I do try to deal with what I call the New World Order and the End of Nations. What we do have is a global transformation. Not just ufology went through changes, but the world went through changes. What happened in the 1980s? Well, in a sense, you could argue that nations died or were dealt a mortal blow. You have the true escalation and ramping up of globalization. We all remember the NAFTA debate in the early 90s. There were changes in the IMF and the World Bank, too, that went on at this time to facilitate the end of nations. I chatted at length about this with Catherine Austin Fitz, who told me, I mean, personally, she said, Rich, it was an explicit decision of the Bush White House in 1990 to export the U.S. economy to China, end quote. Now, if you're thinking old school, like this is my country, I'm leading my country, why would you engage in such an act of economic self-mutilation? Well, you wouldn't, I don't think. But you would if your bosses are international financial elites who say this is what you're going to do. So who's in charge? Is it the Bilderbergers, the Trilaterals, the Council on Foreign Relations? Well, yeah, maybe, sure. Why is that so hard to gather? Bilderbergers meet every single year. No one covers them in the media. They're bigger and badder and tougher than the G20. And they get no media coverage. Why? So when we talk about disclosure, we have to ask from whom? From the president? Well, what is the president? Is he anything more than a sales rep? I'm serious. I mean, that's what he is. He's here to sell you two things, okay? He's going to sell you globalization, which is a bitter pill to swallow, and he's going to sell you whatever new war comes down the pike, whether his name is George W. Bush or Barack Obama, who increasingly sounds like Bush Light on Afghanistan and on the bailout. Let's face it. Is there much of a difference here? So that's the book. Summarizing, we talk about an era of major transition, going from the old order, the old thoughts, to the new thoughts. We talk about ceaseless UFO encounters worldwide, many of which are military, new perceptions by researchers toward this phenomenon, a repoliticization of ufology. Yes. I call this book The Cover-Up Exposed. That's the subtitle for a reason, because I believe what happened is in these two decades, the cover-up was exposed. It wasn't outed in an official media sense. It wasn't outed by the mainstream, but it was exposed in a way that was absolutely not even imaginable in the 1960s. But it happened in the 70s and 80s. We had counter-initiatives by the intelligence community during this period as well. And we have a global transformation driven by technology and by politics. This book is not done. It's done. The writing's done. It's not in print. It will be available, I believe, within 2 months. I urge you to check my website periodically. It will be available soon. You'll be able to get it off my website or off Amazon. Thank you very much. It went a little long.